The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Headaches, motor neuron disorders, and amyotrophies is presented by Dr. Scott Spradlin.
We're going to spend the next 30 minutes talking about headaches, motor disorders, and amyotrophies. And there's a lot of information here, but try to focus exactly what you would need for your examination. So I think we'll successfully get through here. So we're going to learn about the classification and type of headaches, the classification of the myopathies, and then discuss some of the movement disorders and treatments. So start with the question. 28-year-old female has a throbbing, one-sided, three times a month headache. It occurs suddenly and persists for 2 days. This is what type of headache? Is it a migraine with aura, a migraine without aura, a tension-type headache, or a cluster headache? And if you don't know the answer, you will at the end of this lecture. That's going to be a migraine without aura. And critical things, once again, just like in the other questions, we'll talk about. But the key things in this question is throbbing versus non-throbbing and unilateral versus bilateral. So let's talk about migraines. They can be unilateral, they are intermittent, and they are throbbing. Those are words that are going to have to be in a question if they're routing you toward a migraine. They last about 4 hours to 3 days. There can be light sensitivity or sound sensitivity, and that's the aura. It can be associated with a prodrome, and it can be a number of different items. They can have scintillating scotomas as a point, and then triggers can be from anything from light to wind to cologne, et cetera. And there is a migraine with no pain at all, and it's called an acephalic migraine. And it's you really have no headache, but they can have vision disturbances. So if you get a board question where someone comes in and says, you know, I was driving down the road and I felt kind of weird, and all at once I just couldn't see real well, and it lasted for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then I came in because I'm just not really sure, and you do a fundo exam because you're experts on retina fundo exams now after this course, and you look at it and you don't really see anything, think about an acephalic migraine. They're more common than you think. So there are a number of headaches, and some of them tend to make it to the board, so we'll quickly go through some of these. So acute treatment for a migraine is going to be a triptan or a serotonin agonist. You can use non-steroidals. You can use ergotamine. You can use dopamine antagonists. Once again, opiates are rarely recommended, and only in severe refractory ones. If they would put you toward one of those in a board, it'd have to be one that has gone to a tertiary headache center. DHE is going to be given intravenously for severe onset, and for chronic headaches, you can use botulinum toxin A. So prophylactically, any person that has a migraine that you've done an acute treatment and that actually has a trigger, you would want to use some prophylaxis. Beta blockers, tricyclic antidepressants. You can use osteopathic manipulative therapy as a prophylactic treatment. And there's not one of these going to be preferable to the other one, even though I would tell you that probably beta blockers and tricyclics or possibly OMT would be prevalent to the neurological medications. So let's talk about cluster headaches. Cluster headaches occur daily for weeks and then stop. For a board question, you're going to have to use terminology like it's an ice pick-like feeling. It's associated with REM or early in the morning, So if that person wakes up and says, this is the worst headache of my life, it's like someone's trying to crack me at my head open. The pain peaks in 5 to 10 minutes and then throbs for about 2 hours. You can have an associated ipsilateral Horner syndrome. It's usually more prevalent in males, drinkers, and smokers. Drinkers and smokers are always lucky. They get all the diseases. Tall and thin and hazel eye color. So the treatment for that is going to be 5-HT1 receptor agonists, triptans, or good alkaloids. The thing here that would be good for a board question is that oxygen is a treatment. And as you know, a lot of people go to the emergency room for a lot of things. Many of those is because it's open when they need them. And people will come in with a headache. What's the first thing they do? They put oxygen on people. Their headache begins to get all better, and it goes away. And it's really a cool thing in a history. You know, for some reason, every time I go to the ER, my headache's all better. And it's because they blow the oxygen in. And there's a lot of cluster headaches that get relief with that. Lidocaine intranasal drops are a treatment option, as well as corticosteroids. And prophylactically, you use a calcium channel blocker. Tension headaches, differentiating a migraine headache from a tension headache on a board exam, the bolded word there is what it is. It has to be a non-throbbing pain, where the migraine is going to be a throbbing pain. It's due to chronic muscle contraction. It could have a vascular component. It usually comes daily, almost at the same time, and it's usually bilateral, and it's not unilateral, like what you would have with a migraine, and it's a tight band-like feeling. Treatment for that are non-steroidals, muscle relaxants. Fair answer for this would be is ergonomical setup in the situation you're in, especially in the new world of electronics. SSRIs, tricyclic antidepressants, and beta blockers. So let's look at some of the other headaches. Coital headache is usually benign. This is a person that has a headache after sexual relations. Usually a treatment for that is either propranolol or indomethacin. Post-traumatic is a vascular type approach. You treat that the same as you would a migraine. Temporal arteritis, if you haven't figured that's going to be on the board, I know you've heard it. I've sat back here and heard at least been said 7 or 10 times, know everything there is to know about temporal arteritis. You're going to have someone over the age of 55, sudden onset arteritis. There's temporal artery tenderness. SED rate's usually extremely elevated. It's got to be above 60. And for a board exam, historically, the focus has always been on treating before the biopsy. So you give the steroids before you do the biopsy. The reason is because that inflammation and diagnosis will still be there after. Pseudotumor cerebri, obese premenopausal women, there's an associated diplopia headache. There's usually a visual field loss. They could give you a retinal exam and you see that papilledema. And so when they do that, one of the distractors is going to say malignant hypertension, so I don't want you to just pick that, because we all know that you could certainly have high blood pressure associated with headache as well. The CSF is going to be pretty high at 250 millimeters of, and the treatment for that is going to be diuretics and steroids. Thalamic, as the evolution of stroke treatment, and we'll talk a little bit about that later, in the stroke lecture, but when people have had a thalamic infarct, there's an associated incredible pain. And a lot of times they can't articulate that pain, and so it can actually have a hemianesthesia effect, almost it looks like a stroke, but usually these are associated with thalamic infarcts. Motor disorders. Parkinson's disease. This is great for boards because it's made by clinical diagnosis solely. There's not a test you can do for that. There is a dopamine transporter scan or CT spec that you can do to kind of evaluate. Causes decreased dopamine production in the substantia nigra. The signs and symptoms are going to be that resting tremor, the rigidity, the retarded movement, and the loss of the postural reflexes. So this chart I find to be pretty helpful because there's other things that can mimic that, that can be distractors on the on a board question. So if you get a tremor, there's a whole bunch of tremors, right? So what is a Parkinson tremor? If a Parkinson tremor, it's going to be asymmetric, whereas with essential tremor, it's going to be bilateral. You're going to have that bradykinesia, you know, whereas with a carpal tunnel or some of the radiculopathies, you'll have altered reflexes with sensation and strength. You won't have that with Parkinson's. So those are key things in the question. Rigidity, that cogwheel rigidity, but you can also have rigidity with musculoskeletal systems, but there's always going to be pain. So for them, for them to be able to differentiate, you're going to have to see that word pain, because people that have Parkinson's don't have pain associated with that. And then the gait disorders, which is a little tougher, there's an asymmetric slowness and shuffling, whereas in Parkinson's, where in the multiple ischemic lesions, like the hydrocephalus or any of those, you're going to have a shuffled wide-based gait, which is differentiating. Treatment for that is just going to be increase the dopamine. I really wouldn't be worried about differentiating between this. They should be fair. It's either going to be a sentiment or the anticholinergics or primarily the recrypts or the Azalex. The refractory treatment, it's reasonable to know that you can do deep brain stimulation, but it's going to have to be refractory. And surgery is kind of the last resort, but deep brain stimulation is becoming more prevalent. And this is just kind of a medication for quick reference, but not for right now. Progressive supranuclear palsy. We talked about it yesterday. It's similar to Parkinson's. There's an erect posture. They've got a hyperextended neck. There's no tremor, though. So this is going to be, on a board question, it's going to be like a person that sounds like Parkinson's, but they're not mentioning a tremor. Vertical ophthalmoplegia, I mentioned this yesterday, they can't look up or down. It's classic of progressive supranuclear palsy. And over several years, they're essentially just unable to walk. A good board question for this would be the fact that, you know, I can't take mom to the mall anymore because she loves to go, but as she goes up the escalator and she raises her head, she falls down and scares me to death. That's going to be a pretty classic. There's really no definitive treatment. Huntington's chorea. It's inherited, it's autosomal dominant. You're going to have hemibolismus, facial twitching, rigidity with dystonia, the HD gene. There's a decreased GABA in the laboratory. The CT's going to show a bulge of the caudate nucleus with enlarged ventricles. And the treatment for that is going to be tetrabenazine, amantadine, or riluzole. Remember, the riluzole is also the same treatment for Lou Gehrig's. Benign tremor. We kind of touched on it a bit. Back in the Parkinson's. It's not to be confused with a normal tremor. It's about 7 hertz. It's autosomal dominant and it's familial. Say my dad has this too. That's going to be classic to drive you to that in a board question. Treatment for that's going to be beta blockers or primidone. And this is a lot more prevalent than, I put it right there between essential tremor and doc, my hands are soaking wet all the time and I'm in sales. It can't be that way. So benign tremor is a fair one that they want to make sure that you're treating correctly. Tardive dyskinesia, it's caused by long-term antipsychotics. There's usually that lip smacking, tongue face, neck movement. It can affect the limbs, but it's primarily going to be in that facial area. You exchange the dopamine antagonist, so the treatment for that is going to be stop what they're on and exchange for another antipsychotic. Neuromalignant syndrome, it is an anesthesiological emergency, and so it's really important you visualize that, especially when they call you in after the urologist has done something and say, you know, this guy's temperature's 105, I don't know what to do. It's always going to be a presentation similar to that. They're going to have a very high fever. Usually that neuromalignant syndrome is coming from the anesthesia. They can also come from antipsychotics, but that temperature's got to be high. You're going to have to be talking 105, 106. If they're steering you towards sepsis, it's going to be 102, 101, but they're going to have to show you it's a really high temperature. There's going to be rigidity. There's going to be increased CK. In a board question, you're going to talk about the urine looks dingy, or there's going to be an altered metastasis. You need to remove those drugs, supportive therapy, especially for the hyperthermia, and then either dantrolene or bromocriptine or mantine could be necessary. Most of the time, just redrawing it and monitoring supportive care, it gets get back to okay. Tic de la Rue, there's a hemifacial spasm with facial pain, and it's associated with a trigeminal neuralgia. 80% of those have a basilar artery affecting the facial nerve, and the treatment for that is carbazepine and surgical intervention sometimes. Gilles de la Tourette, neuroleptics, you treat with risperidone or geodon. Torticollis, treatment for that's going to really be botulinum. Meg syndrome. Made it to the boards. It's a bilateral blepharospasm with lip and mouth movement. And Creutzfeldt-Jakob, not so much the topic, but it could be a distractor. It's myoclonus with dementia, brain biopsy, and there really isn't much treatment. And, of course, that would be a giveaway question because someone who had to have been traveling and eating something or from an area where they were preparing some form of brains. Normally not in the United States. There's quite a few in foreign countries. So, seizures, go through these kind of quick. Excessive abnormal discharge of electrical activity, as we know. Epilepsy is a syndrome of recurrent episodes of seizure activity. There's two types, partial and generalized. Partial is also known as focal or local seizures. That usually occur in a specific area. There's a sensory phenomenon. There's autonomic manifestations as well as psychic manifestations. So you'll have that pause, stare look. When you look at the generalized seizures, there is absence, which is sudden, brief motor activity, blank stare, unconscious. Myoclonic is that jerk, that uncontrollable muscle group movement, and they're usually unconscious and have confusion postictally, usually just supportive care and evaluation, or they forgot to take their medications for the most part. Tonic-clonic seizures, a grand mal, otherwise may or may not have an aura. There's a sudden loss of consciousness. There's the tonic phase, which is the abrupt increase in muscle tone, and then the clonic phase, which is the rhythmic muscle contraction and relaxation. Status epilepticus, it's continuous seizures. Fair board question is, say, were they really in status or not? From criteria, they need to be having continuous seizures greater than 5 minutes, or repeated seizure for 30 minutes or longer, and going into another seizure without recovery from the first one is be pretty much giving you the status epilepticus. A lot of times that word is a kind of overused. And then complex partial seizure is purposeful repetitive activities, and it evolves to a secondary generalized seizure usually. So let's look at the myopathies. So the workup for a myopathy. If they're taking you down a myopathy pathway, you're going to have a CK on there. There's going to be some form of electrolytes, serum myoglobin. The urinalysis in a myopathy usually there's myoglobinuria, which is indicated by with a few red blood cells on microscopic evaluation. There's a complete blood count, a SED rate, because there's usually an inflammatory component, thyroid functions, liver functions. Once again, always remember age-appropriate screening, and then some specific genetic testing can be necessary. As you saw from the prior lecture, there's a lot of myopathy with these autosomal and recessive ones. So let's go to some of the most obscure ones first. McArdle's disease is a really glycogen storage disorder. The key features of this for a board exam is that someone will be going, it'll usually be younger people. This is going to be determined pretty right at the course of turning from pediatrics to internal medicine. But they're going to have these cramps with short, strenuous exercise, but when they stop, it goes away. So there's a second wind phenomenon. The CK at rest is usually increased, and usually a muscle biopsy shows glycogen accumulation. With a CPT deficiency, Usually they have myalgia and tenderness, but there's no cramps. And it doesn't go away when they stop. They just kind of feel that way continuously. And the CK at rest is normal. So let's look at Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. It has been one that we all know about, but there's been some evolutions. I think it makes it reasonable for it to come back to the boards. It's X-linked. There's progressive weakness. It usually begins when they're very young until young adult. Weakness is usually more proximal versus distal. There's an elevated CK. Over about 2.5 years now, we've actually got some specific genetic treatment for people that have the exon 51, and it's Exondys 51 as a treatment. Deflazacort is also a steroid that helps. Remember, there's also been evolutions in the spinal muscle atrophy categories of 1, 2, and 3, and Spinraza, and now we have Zolgensma that's coming out on the market very, very soon. Not for the boards, but I think Exondys could possibly make it. Myotonic dystrophy, you just heard about it in a prior lecture. Have you ever seen one? No. But it's wonderful for a board exam. And I'll tell you why. It's an inherited neuromuscular disorder. It's autosomal dominant. And its symptoms are weakness, sleep apnea, cardiac conduction defects, mitral valve prolapse, and testicular atrophy. What could be a better board question? Right? So you're going to get an EKG with a conduction defect. You're going to have somebody that has an AHI less than 10. And have an echo with a mitral valve with associated weakness. That's myotonic dystrophy. Mitochondrial myopathies are also known as MELOS, or mitochondrial encephalopathies with lactic acidosis. It's inherited maternal. It is a defect of the mitochondria. There's always an associated lactic acidosis. So this, the CO2 is going to be 18 or less. There's going to be muscle weakness, ptosis, and neurological findings exist. These individuals are very prone to early stroke. They can also have renal and liver abnormalities, and some of these can even end up on dialysis. The critical feature here is there's going to be red, ragged fibers on muscle biopsy. Metabolic. Disorders exist, and we got to don't forget those, diabetes mellitus, which is definitely one of the most common syndromes to go give myopathic changes, as well as the neuropathies that we talked about earlier. Addison's disease, particularly when fluid and electrolyte problems are present. Cushing's, remember that from your lecture from Dr. Sutton and Dr. Snitzer. And then the thyroids, either hypo or hyper, can give you a metabolic issues as well as hyperparathyroidism and Kahn's syndrome. Periodic paralysis. It's one that I want you to understand real well because it could be on a distractor. Can be a normokalemic paralysis that causes most severe and prolonged attacks. Patients usually feel well between attacks, but sometimes they have myotonia and residual weakness after repeated episodes. There's an acute hypokalemic paralysis, may be primary or secondary due to excessive renal or GI losses or even an endocrinopathy. Familial periodic paralysis usually occurs in males, and it's autosomal dominant and can last as long as 36 hours. The attacks usually occur at night or early in the morning upon awakening and can be precipitated by a diet high in carbohydrates or a rest following exercise. And so you've got to be able to determine this based on how the question is versus the restless leg syndrome that you heard about in our sleep lecture. Let's talk about the inflammatory. Just to remind you, because they touched on this during a couple of the other lectures, the dermatomyositis and polymyositis, there's proximal muscle weakness. The EMG shows myopathic changes consistent with inflammation. And MRIs go show muscular inflammatory components and that they do respond to glucosteroids. Inclusion body myositis. sounds, looks, and feels completely like dermatomyositis and polymyositis, but it does not respond to steroids. So if you get a board question, it sounds like dermatomyositis, they give them steroids and say they're not any better, it's probably inclusion body myositis. And the biopsies go show vacular inclusions with the eosinophils, but that's not real helpful for you to differentiate it. So remember the steroids. Unless you're just a histological champion out there. Infections, remember, there's certain parasites and spirochetes as well as bacteria that can cause myopathies. So if you get a person that is a wrestler who developed a myopathy, think about MRSA or strep. Pretty classic, kind of following what the flavor is in the literature. Lyme's disease made it for a good while. It's kind of fell off. Syphilis has always been a master myopathy maker. Trichinosis, toxoplasmosis, and cysticercosis certainly has, as well as viral. HIV neuropathy, influenza has associated myopathies post that, as well as some of the more common viruses like adenovirus and Coxsackie. Toxic, don't forget the drugs. We've got a lecture today on drugs and side effects, but drugs can cause myopathies. Some of the ones there I've kind of highlighted that I think are fair is omeprazole, a very common drug that's been used that can cause that. In the general population, as well as the classic statin, fenofibrate, niacin. Steroids can give a steroid myopathy, as well as antivirals and protease inhibitors. But many of the others, like cocaine, diuretics, amiodarone, colchicine, chloroquine, and the classic tryptophan. Myasthenia gravis. It's an autoimmune motor implant disorder. It's associated with thymomas. They have diplopia and ptosis is present. The symptoms worsen as the days progresses. The diagnosis of that is going to be a tensilon test and checking for anti-acetylcholine receptor antibodies. And the treatment for that is going to be mestinon or a thymectomy. Or in crisis, you may need to do a plasma exchange or IVIG. So a board question is to go have a person that wakes up, have a worsening eyelid droop, weakness, and double vision. Lambert-Eaton, fair for a combined neurological pulmonary question. It's usually always associated with Oates cell carcinoma. So if you've had a chest x-ray on a board exam, it shows an Oates cell carcinoma. It can be autoimmune. It's presymmetric peripheral nerve antibodies that causes the acetylcholine release to decrease. They can have proximal muscle weakness, dry mouth, hyperreflexia with in the lower extremities. If you see that associated with an Oates cell carcinoma or without, that's probably Eaton-Lambert syndrome. And the treatment for that is anticholinesterase agents.